It's now time for Just the Terror with Nick Guerra.
My life in a funeral home.
I'm a female in my late 20s. My parents, a charming lesbian couple, own a funeral home and cemetery in a village on the outskirts of the Alaskan tundra. It was a small business that had been passed down from my mother, Agatha's father, who had inherited it from his father, and so on. Katie, my other mother, was terrified of the whole situation from the beginning. She was positive that someone would get possessed with us living so close to a field of corpses, her words. Over time, exactly 8 years after they moved there, she grew to respect the land as well as the tenants resting in peace there. I was born shortly after her change of heart, but she still limited my access to the cemetery. And while no one was ever possessed, we still had our fair share of terrifying experiences at our home and throughout the property. I went to a tiny schoolhouse every weekday from the time I could walk. Only 30 or so children lived in our town, so we were all educated in one room by a small group of teachers. Katie and her twin sister Gloria were two of the teachers. The three of us would walk to and from town every day, while Aga and her brother Cal took care of the property. It was a 20-minute trek, but on the occasional day without freezes, we got to take our bikes, and that was generally the highlight of my life. However, on this particular day in December, we had to walk. We were only at school until about 4 o'clock that afternoon, but the sun usually set around 3:30, so we were shrouded mostly in darkness by the time we got to the dirt road leading up to our property. I was about 6 or 7 at the time, and I still used my clumsiness as an excuse not to walk up the path muddied by the snow. Gloria had drawn the short straw and was giving me a piggyback ride up the hill. I was resting my head against her back, staring at the cemetery that was beginning to come into view around the paper birches and spruce trees. It was a sprawling field filled with an odd assortment of mausoleums, colorful tombs of Inuit and the Russian Orthodox citizens. I was always entranced by the graves and tried to pick out the ones that I had yet to see. We were nearly to the house when I saw a figure standing in the far right corner of the cemetery. It was hard to discern their age or gender, but I could tell from the build that it wasn't Agatha or Cal. Visiting hours ended at sundown regardless of the date, so I immediately pointed the person out to Katie. Now, most of the finer details are recalled by my parents and older family members due to my young age throughout most of these events, but I can still clearly remember hearing Katie mutter, "Fuck," quietly under her breath. She helped me off of Gloria's back and ordered that I go inside to tell Cal to meet them in the field. Without hesitation, I suddenly found myself as sure-footed as a bunny on the icy ground and sprinted the last 20 yards or so up to the house. I swung the door open and went into the kitchen where I knew I'd find Aga and Cal and told my uncle to get the trespasser. Groaning, Cal finished his cup of coffee, which was probably spiked with whiskey, and stood from the table. Cal was a big guy, maybe about 6'8", with broad shoulders and what I call Fred Flintstone fists. Basically, he could knock someone out without much effort, and he did so time and time again. He was insanely protective of his sisters and all of the other women in his life, Glory and Katie included. The entire town respected him and feared him at the same time. He was a nice at-home security system. Naturally, I was thrilled with this tiny bit of excitement in my normally humdrum life. When my uncle charged out the back without so much as a coat on, I turned my pleading eyes to Aga, who barely flinched at the activity. She stared back at me for only a moment before sighing and motioning to the rack by the door. I grabbed her parka and helped her put it on as we made our way outside. Knowing that her wife was going to be none too thrilled with my presence in the cemetery, Aga picked me up when we reached the cast iron fence that surrounded the property. We could see Cal's giant silhouette approaching the tiny ones of Katie and Glory. The stranger was still a good 100 yards or so from all of us. "Let's hide and watch," I whispered to Aga when I realized that Katie hadn't spotted us yet. For a moment, I thought my mother would shake her head and go to the others, but she surprised me by giving me a conspiring smile and ducking behind a mausoleum. "We can get to grandmother's grave if we're very quiet," she told me with a glint in her eye. She loved the graveyard and had spent her childhood playing in it while also learning about her ancestors and the people of her town. She wanted me to enjoy it as much as she did. We hurried from grave to grave, pausing only long enough to make sure that the others didn't see us. Katie, Gloria, and Cal were moving swiftly as well, they were too busy eyeing the figure standing only about 20 feet from the large tomb that encased my great-grandmother, our destination. When we arrived at the tomb, Aga set me down and we crouched behind the rocks and wood that surrounded grandmother's altar. It was then that I began to feel nerves eat away at my gut. This was a stranger, I could tell. They were standing at the base of the mausoleum built to honor the infants who passed before being blessed by the tribe's shaman. This was an old, outdated site that didn't fully honor Inuit customs, though, and it had been redone in the 1970s closer to the northern section of the property. No one came to the site because it would be considered disrespectful to their deceased, but it would have been just as disrespectful to tear it down. So, it was just a derelict memorial that loomed on the tiny hilltop of that section of the cemetery. Tension filled the air as Cal, flanked by Katie and Gloria, approached the stranger. I could hear my uncle speaking to him, likely telling them our hours and asking if they'd like a ride back to town. He always started off nice, giving people the benefit of the doubt before going into Hulk mode. Aga, who had initially been giggling at the sight of her brother looming over the trespasser, was beginning to cling tighter to me as time went on. It took us a few minutes to realize that the person hadn't been responding to Cal, nor had they even looked his way. They just continued to stare at the area just above the mausoleum. Katie and Gloria were exchanging uneasy glances, and at one point Cal told them to go back to the house. They refused and stepped closer to his side. When words failed, Cal resorted to the physical approach. He later recalled that he could tell the person, an old man, was frail and that he didn't want to hurt him. But he wasn't listening, and if he was deaf, he'd have to get his attention somehow. My uncle placed a gentle hand on the gentleman's shoulder and immediately felt a wave of nausea overcome him. He hunched over, clutching his abdomen, and cried out. Aga ordered me to stay put before darting out behind the stones and over to her brother, who waved her and the other women off. He insisted that they go inside, but they were all frozen in place. The strange man still hadn't moved, so Katie yelled at him once more. She stepped around in front of him and waved a hand in his face. "You need to leave," I heard her command. "You can't be here after dark. It's not safe." The stranger finally said, "No, it's not." He lowered his eyes to smile at my mother. "Are you all right, dear?" He spoke so casually to her that she stood there in shock for a good moment. She looked back to Cal, who was on his knees at this point. While she was distracted, the man turned, headed towards the exit. When he was coming towards my hiding spot, I had every intention of getting up and running away, but I was frozen in place. It felt like my body was being held down by weights and I was sinking into the earth. I whimpered and buried my face in my arms, praying to God and my great-grandmother for safety. The ice and leaves crunched in my ears, and I knew Aga realized my predicament and said something to the others because I could hear Katie shouting at her. Finally, summoning the courage, I looked up to see the man walking right by me. He didn't so much as look my way, but as he passed, he said, "Good night, Blue Eyes," in a dulcet whisper. Immediately, I relaxed and climbed to my feet. I watched him practically float out of the cemetery and towards the road. Katie came and got me, telling me that we had to take my uncle to the hospital. As it turns out, Cal had to go in for emergency surgery because his appendix ruptured. He's convinced that the old man somehow cursed him on contact. Even Aga, sweet but superstitious Aga, had her doubts about his claims. There's nothing malicious in Cal's approach to the man, so why would he have cursed him? This wasn't the last time we saw the strange man. We actually saw him two or three more times in the following weeks. He was always at the derelict infant mausoleum, staring up at the sky. He never spoke or bothered anyone, and from that point on, he always came while it was light out. I would sometimes sneak out and watch him from grandmother's grave. It was a white man, which struck a chord with me. It was my theory that he was Katie and Gloria's real father who had abandoned them when they were still very young. Katie quickly disproved this theory, telling me that her father died in the early 90s, but that meant nothing to me. It could still be him. The last time I saw him was in early February the following year. It was snowing heavily, and I was helping Aga and Cal go about and check to see if all the tombs and mausoleums were closed. Sometimes family members of the deceased would perform rituals on their newly departed, placing ceremonial offerings on their bodies, but they wouldn't always restore the tombs to the way they were. We did our best to ensure that none of the graves would be flooded come the next thaw. When we approached grandmother's grave, I heard Aga sigh airily but continue on. Immediately, I looked to the old mausoleum and smiled at the back of the old man. I called out to him, "Good morning." "There's no such thing, Blue Eyes," I heard him respond over the wind. I began to laugh because it sounded like something Gloria would say after a night of drinking. But suddenly, I felt a ball of sadness coil up in my stomach. I began crying and looked up at Aga with a sorrowful pout. It was the first time I had ever really felt dread, and it nearly brought me to my knees. Aga picked me up and took me inside, where I instantly felt better. The man was never seen on property again. I was a little sad about it, but the adults were all glad. They didn't like the pull that he had on us.
Part 2. The Man Who Cried Hurt Dog.
This next story is from when my parents first began living together, but first, a little background. Katie grew up in a fairly large city just a few hours from our village. Her mother was a nurse who occasionally brought medical supplies to the more remote areas of the state and provided vaccines for those who wanted them. They met Aga and her family when they were about 9 or 10. They were all friends, and Grandma Mary would sometimes leave Katie and her twin sister Gloria there overnight while she visited other villages. When they reached their teens, Katie and Aga began secretly dating, and eventually they broke the news to their families. Grandma Mary, a devout Catholic, took it surprisingly well. Pawpaw and Ma Aga's parents were a bit unnerved by the whole thing. They had never really dealt with homosexuality within the tribe. They were convinced that their ancestors would strike them down if they allowed two girls to continue their courtship. When the community and council members voted on it, though, they all agreed that as long as Aga and her family maintained their faith and upheld the customs of their people, no harm would come from the union. Once they had the blessings from both women's families, they were allowed to move in together. They were barely 17 at the time, but that was how it was within our village. There were no ceremonies. They just went from living apart to living together. This represented betrothal. The house they moved into was small and only about a half mile away from the main house where we eventually moved, but at the time it was Paw, Paw, and Ma's house. Katie and Aga swear that the shack was once a charming little cottage with a beautiful red door and matching shutters. All I know is that it's currently a condemned structure that gives me splinters by just looking at it. Aga worked with her father on most weekdays. Her older brother was a fisherman. He had no interest in the family business, so my mother was next in line to inherit it. She loved the cemetery and the funeral home because she felt that she provided a place for closure to those who were going through the most difficult time in their lives. Sometimes she worked long hours, so Katie spent most of her time in the town teaching or at the house cleaning and cooking. At the time, she wasn't too put off with the cemetery in her backyard. It was a peaceful place, and she never really gave it a second thought. One afternoon, she was outside cleaning the windows. She had music playing from the radio inside, so she didn't hear the truck approaching on the dirt path until it was right behind her. She didn't recognize it as one of Aga's family member vehicles, so she immediately stopped what she was doing so she could welcome the stranger. She was a debutante, and hospitality was very important. The man who stepped out of the truck was white, which wasn't odd. There were a few white families in the valley, and even some Russians. They rarely made it to this part of the property, though. The main house was where the funeral home was, and all business was performed up there. Thinking that he may have been lost, Katie waved at the gentleman, who had to have been in his late 30s or early 40s. He was handsome, with an almost rugged look to him, she recalled. Overall, he seemed very approachable. The only thing that seemed off about him was his lack of jacket. He was only wearing a flannel shirt and blue jeans. It was 30 degrees out, and our town is in a part of the country where it was sometimes dark all day. This was one of those times. With no sun and a substantial amount of wind, it was foolish to go outside without some sort of coat. Katie was only out there because the dirty windows were driving her nuts. She asked him, "How can I help you?" as he meandered towards the porch. "Do you have a dog?" the guy said, seeming out of breath as he looked about the property, as though he were looking for something. Katie told him, "No, no dog." The stranger pointed to the wooded area on the east side of the property. "There's a dog stuck in a trap just off the path over there. Do you know who it might belong to? It's brown with a black muzzle." Immediately, Katie stepped off the porch and looked towards the trees. "I have no idea. Could you not get it out of the trap?" She was, and still is, a sucker for animals. She has a habit of bringing home strays and injured wildlife to this day. The gentleman pointed to his truck. I don't have any tools with me. Do you have a crowbar or even a screwdriver? I can probably take the trap apart if you don't mind keeping the thing calm while I do it. It didn't occur to Katie that it would probably have been better to get someone strong to assist him, that zeroing in on the petite woman who could barely reach the top of her windows was a strange move. It also didn't occur to her that the man had driven from a different part of the property, and that he would have come from the other side of the house if he was coming from the woods. All she knew was that a dog was hurt, and she wanted to help. She ran into the house and dug through the chest where they kept the tools that Aga's brother had given them when they moved in. She found the tools he requested, as well as some flashlights, and followed him to his truck. She had not yet been jaded by the world filled with criminals and pervs, so she didn't think twice about going off with a fellow good Samaritan. The man drove fast. When they got close to the edge of the forest, he drove off the path to get to a shortcut that most of the hunters in the area used. It dawned on Katie that the man didn't have a gun rack in the cab of his truck, and that he was hardly dressed for a hunting trip. She glanced at the floor and behind her seat, searching for a coat or some kind of jumper that he may have changed out of, but she didn't see anything of the sort. When the truck stopped, she asked him about his attire. She suggested that they go to her brother-in-law's cabin to get a coat. He immediately refused. He explained, "My jacket's with the dog," motioning for her to follow him up the path. The poor thing looked cold, and I wanted him to at least be a little comfortable while he waited for me. This eased Katie's nerves. He was a nice guy taking care of a dog. They walked up the path that Katie had only ever been on once or twice before. As kids, they explored the woods, but they never went in this area with fear of being shot. With no daylight, they would at least be safe from hunters, but there were still other elements to worry about. Bears, foxes. The man led the way, shining the flashlight over the path to make sure they were going the right way. They walked for nearly a half hour before Katie stopped and took in the surroundings. She asked if they were getting close to the dog, and the gentleman nodded. "It's near the pass up ahead. He's sort of off the path, so keep an ear out." The man turned and gave her a smile that even today she calls charming in a Ted Bundy kind of way. As though he sensed her discomfort, the guy started a little dialogue with her. I'm Aaron, by the way. I live out by the border. Are you from around these parts?" Confused, Katie bit back the urge to throw a no shit at him or something. He had just taken her from her house. What did he think? That she was a tourist who cleaned windows for giggles? Rather than be rude, she hummed an affirmative while shining her light to the right and then her left, looking for the dog. Aaron went on, "And you're married?" When Katie asked what brought him to that conclusion, he reminded her that she mentioned a brother-in-law. "Is your husband not home?" Katie corrected, "Wife, actually. She's down the road. She'll be home soon." She felt that it was important to add that, even though it wasn't true. Aga wasn't expected home for another few hours, actually. But she wanted to make sure this guy knew she might have people looking for her soon. Aaron was quiet for a few seconds. They reached a rocky incline on the trail, and he seemed to be focusing on that. Once the silence began to settle, he let out a chuckle. "That's pretty hot," he said. "Two women and all." While grateful that he wasn't like a lot of people when they first found out about the relationship, rude and disgusted, Katie almost found his reaction even worse. For the sake of remaining polite, she faked a laugh. Sure. He stopped walking and turned to face her. "So, how do you, you know?" Katie really hoped that he wasn't talking about what she thought he was talking about. "How do we what?" "Have sex," he clarified with a casual shrug. Disgusted, Katie stepped back. "That's none of your business." She tried to remain calm, but the man's sudden change in attitude had her on edge. "Can we just please get to the dog?" Oh yeah. Aaron looked around as though he forgot why they were there in the first place. He laughed sheepishly and shook his head. "I'm so sorry, man, but there's not a dog. I brought you out here for sex." His cavalier attitude gave Katie pause. She let his words sink in for a second, figuring that she had to have misheard. When he began to unzip his pants, she knew that she heard right. In Katie's retelling of the event, some small details change every here and there, but one thing that always stays the same is her response at that exact moment of realization. Shit. She didn't give him a chance before slamming her flashlight repeatedly into his head, throat, and chest. She basically hit him as many times as she could until he fell to the ground. When she knew he was unconscious, she turned on heel and ran back where they came from. She didn't know exactly where she was, but she figured that if she stayed on the path, that she would eventually find her way. She was right. She saw the truck at the edge of the field, right at the opening of the path. She checked the vehicle and was relieved to see that he left the keys in the ignition. She drove it across the field towards the main house, where she found Papa, Aga, and Aga's brother Cal. The three were horrified when they heard her account of what had happened. The men immediately went into the woods to find the injured man. Meanwhile, Aga called the authorities, aka Jimmy, the town-appointed sheriff, with a collection of European muskets and three dogs that could tear the skin off a man's bones if ordered to. Jimmy arrived as Papa and Cal were returning, with the latter pulling Aaron by the foot through the mud. He was taken to jail, aka the concrete cell off of Jimmy's house, where he remained until the police from a nearby city came to collect him and perform an official investigation. As it turns out, Aaron was a fisherman from the coast. He visited friends in our area once or twice a year. He had tagged along with some of these friends when they were visiting Cal at the funeral home. At some point, it was innocently mentioned that Katie was at the house and that she was home alone, something like that. When he found himself some alone time, Aaron borrowed a truck and found the house and the beautiful Katie alone as promised. They never really got an answer as to why he thought it was okay to take a woman into the woods for nefarious reasons. He was a relatively attractive guy and he seemed normal for the most part. In the end, he got a little bit of prison time and he was banned from our village. That was the most they could really do, given that he didn't actually do anything to Katie. After all, he was the one who came out of it with injuries. That's one of the rare occasions that something scary happened on our property that didn't involve the cemetery or funeral home, but it was definitely the first time one of my mothers came face to face with the true evils of the world.
Part 3. The Beast That Possessed Him.
When I was still a baby, my Aunt Dawn's friend Eddie came to work for us. He didn't have any qualifications other than being strong and willing to work around dead people, so he was hired. Eddie was a bit weird, and according to Aga, he had a super obvious crush on Dawn. Dawn, the sweet summer child, didn't think anything of it. She insisted that he was just a shy kid who didn't know how to talk to people, let alone girls. With her being the prettiest girl in her class, she took it upon herself to befriend the older teen. She was only about 15 when this all happened, and Eddie was 17. This event does not involve any kind of violence against my aunt, I just want to make that clear. This is simply the story of Eerie Eddie and his first day at the cemetery. Now, a little something about the property. It is an absolute treasure trove of eclectic tombs and mausoleums, but there are also dens and caves close to the woods where nature has been left alone. While there aren't really any animals that use these dwellings, we still leave the spaces be, so that they are there during blizzard season. On the morning that Eddie started, Katie found him taking a nap in one of these dens. He hadn't even been there an hour. A few hours later, he came inside and asked for a snack. Though he hadn't done much work, Katie made him a sandwich, and when he finished eating, she requested that he go into the funeral parlor and help Aga with inventory. He nodded and hurried into the doors that led to the parlor. When Aga came in less than 10 minutes later, Katie asked how Eddie was doing. Aga seemed confused, and when Katie told what she asked the kid to do, she said that he'd never come in. The two went looking for him, and they found him sleeping in one of those empty caskets in the showroom. Fed up and slightly concerned, my parents asked if he'd gotten enough sleep the night before and offered him the guest room for the rest of the day. He could finish his chores the next day if need be. Eddie apologized and declined their offer. He admitted, "It's just a hangover." His face was blank and voice monotone. "I'm okay now." With that, he got to work. He helped Aga with the rest of the inventory, repaired the bulldozer, and even repainted the front gate of the cemetery. He was a model employee by dinner time. Don made him some stew and brought it out to him. I had been a pill all afternoon, crying and screaming because of an earache, and my mothers didn't want to subject anyone outside of the family to the horror. A few minutes after she'd left, Don came back in to get Aga. She said she could hear Eddie screaming, but she couldn't find him. The two sisters went out, and sure enough, there was no peace to be found inside or outside that evening. They tracked Eddie's shouts to the cemetery, but that was the easy part. The graveyard was pretty big and sound traveled funny there. Some places echoed and in other parts the sound was muffled. Papa, my grandfather, always told me that the spirits were restless in the quieter places, and that's why sound didn't travel as much there. They needed a little extra peace until they found themselves. Eddie was probably pissing off a lot of spirits that day because he was practically shrieking. Aga and Don split up, first searching the dens where Katie had seen him that morning, and then spreading throughout the actual tombs. After nearly 20 minutes, Don called for Aga to come over to one of the covered plots near the fence. It was covered because there was to be a burial there the following day. They didn't dig too far normally, due to the ground almost always being frozen, but they still had to clear 3 or 4 feet to make room for the base of the tombs. My Uncle Cal had dug the plot a few days earlier and was going to come over the next day to help Eddie set up the rest of the site. Eddie was lying inside the shallow hole, holding his mangled knee to his chest and screaming. Dawn was staring down at him, at a loss. She was small and couldn't help this big guy if he wasn't fully coherent. Aga was equally as stunned at first, but as soon as she saw the scratches on the kid's face, she assumed that this was some sort of animal attack. Climbing into the hole next to Eddie, Aga turned him onto his back so that she could fully examine him. But as soon as he was facing up, he began screaming about the sun, hurting his eyes, and started scratching at his face. Aga and Dawn tried to calm him, but that failed. Dawn ran to get Cal from the house. Cal was much bigger than Eddie and could easily overpower him if he needed to. When he arrived, he sent his sisters inside. He asked that they call the town doctor and inform him that he was bringing Eddie in immediately. They watched Cal load Eddie into the truck and speed off down the road towards town. It wasn't until early the next morning that they got any kind of answer as to what happened. Eddie was a babbling mess, speaking mostly in broken Inupiaq. When he finally strung together a proper sentence, he began describing a giant, hairless canine beast that attacked him when his back was turned. He said it bit into his shoulder and transformed him into a wolf. Cal, who was very superstitious, believes that Eddie was attacked by a Kikiyun, an Inuit version of the hellhound, only it looks like a supersized baby ferret with fangs. It has never been told that a Kikiyun's bite can mutate a human, but Eddie did in fact have what looked like a pretty nasty bite on his right shoulder. The doctor said it appeared to be a dog bite and it was super infected. Rabies wasn't really an issue in our neck of the woods, but Eddie was still quarantined and we steered clear of stray dogs for a while after the whole ordeal. Eddie never recovered mentally, not that he was stable to begin with. He was constantly trying to tear off his own skin and bite the necks of those who tried to help him. No one was seriously injured by him, luckily. But Eddie ultimately ended up killing himself 2 years later. He slit his wrists with a sterling silver knife that his mother had gotten from her shaman. They believe that it was the only way to rid him of the beast that possessed him.
Part 4, A Desecration.
When I was about 16, my cousins Lena and Vincent were visiting from New Mexico. They are both a few years older than me, but we got along really well. I'm the youngest out of all the grandkids on Katie's side, and the only grandkid on Aga's, so I always looked forward to seeing these two. They were staying with us for a few weeks over the summer, they're both in college by that point, and they wanted to have some time away from the heat before they went back to their rigorous schedules. Their dad, Katie's brother Max, was there as well. He was a paleontologist, and he intended to do some digging in the tundra while he was there. Around the second week of their stay, Katie and Gloria went with Max to his site, leaving Agatha to entertain us youngins. She was feeling a bit under the weather, so she requested that the three of us go out and do some of the maintenance she had been working on in the cemetery. Weeds aren't much of an issue in our neck of the woods, but grass, flowers, and other plants died when the weather was inconsistent. Every June and July, we would go to all the grave sites and clean them up. I'd been relieved of my duties because my cousins were in town, but Aga didn't want it getting backed up. Plus, she promised to drive us into the city the next day and treat us to a dinner and a movie if we helped. Vincent was surprisingly squeamish about the cemetery. He kept asking me why the tombs were so easy to open and freaking out at the possibility of something jumping out at him. It got to the point where Lena and I couldn't take it anymore, and we asked him to go sit on one of the concrete benches that lined the fence. As he was going over to the bench, he let out a groan and covered his nose. He shouted, "What is that smell?" There was an unspoken rule in my family that we were never to speak of hell or demons within the gates of the cemetery. So I immediately shushed my cousin and asked him to say a prayer aloud to ask for forgiveness. But he ignored me and pointed at one of the tombs. He demanded, "Why is that one broken?" I went over to see what he was talking about and was startled to realize that one of our newer tombs, the one belonging to the village shaman's late mother, had a large crack down the middle. It looked as though it had been sloppily broken then reassembled. The intense smell coming from it suggested that the body was well into the decomposition process. For some idiotic reason, I pulled my shirt over my nose and crouched down to further inspect the grave. I shifted some of the smaller pieces of the stone to the side and peered into the hole I made. Of course, the first thing I saw was the old woman's rotten hand. She had died 2 months before at the age of 102. Her skin had been like tissue paper, so her bones were already visible beneath the remaining tissue. The rest of the body was connected, and everything that she had been buried in seemed to be there. When the initial shock from seeing a deteriorated corpse wore off, I did notice something rather shocking. The body was positioned with the head towards the north. In Inuit culture, only men are buried with their head facing north. Females were buried facing the south because they get cold easily. We never would have mixed this up, and even if we had, many people come to view the body for days before it is finally laid to rest. Someone would have said something had she been positioned wrong. This realization is what truly sent me into panic mode. Someone came in and not only desecrated a grave, which is twisted no matter what your culture or belief system is, but they also rearranged the body in a way that could affect their spirit negatively. This woman could now be suffering in the land of souls. I ran inside without a word to my cousins. Aga would know what to do about this. She used to tell me stories of grave robbers from her childhood. These were fishermen from a town over, and their goal was to steal the jewelry and pelts our dead had been buried in. When I finally woke my mother from her NyQuil coma, she quickly put on her jacket and followed me outside to the vandalized grave. Vincent was standing just outside of the cemetery now, his face white as a sheet. He obviously hadn't told Lena about our discovery, because there she was on the other side of the yard plucking dead flowers out of the ground. Aga yelled for her to come and take her brother inside. When Lena waltzed over to us, she noticed Vincent was shaking and taunted him in a high-pitched voice. "Oh, little buddy, did you see a ghost?" To which Vincent replied, "It was a damn body." Aga shoved him towards the house and demanded that he pray for forgiveness. She then asked Lena to call the police in the next city over. Matters such as this one had to be dealt with by higher authorities than the ones our town had to offer. Surprisingly, Aga allowed me to stay behind and help her examine it. I chalked this up to her being drunk on NyQuil. She was just as stunned with the state of the grave and the body inside. Her experience prior to this had been in greedy white men who wanted some quality ivory and Labradorite jewelry. For some reason, that was easier to accept than someone deliberately dooming the spirits of those who were laid to rest. The police came, along with the shaman of the next village over. The one in our town was unable to perform the proper ceremony due to his relationship with the deceased. We have all been assured that the woman's spirit is now at peace. There were no suspects as to who desecrated the grave, and it never happened again, so the police didn't really follow up with us. My cousins refused to go into the cemetery after that.
Part 5, Broken Rules.
As I've mentioned before, I was generally restricted from going into the cemetery by myself when I was younger. Up until I was about 11 or 12, I was glued to my parents' side when we walked the property. My Uncle Cal used to be the top candidate as my chaperone when neither of my mothers were available. He's a pretty solid dude, and he's willing to knock out anyone who poses a threat to me or anyone else in my family. One morning when I was 6 years old, my mothers needed to be at the school to discuss an upcoming festival. Cal wasn't what you would consider a natural when it came to kids. He was so nice, and he did his very best when he was left to care for me, but he never really mastered the art of talking or playing with me. For example, on this particular day, he decided to play hide-and-seek with me. This wasn't anything new to me. I played all the time with my moms and aunts, but they always knew to go over the rules very carefully before we played. Rule number one, stay in the yard and don't go into the cemetery. Rule number two, do not hide in any holes or dens made by animals. Rule number three, always come out of your hiding spot when the seeker yelled, "Ollie, Ollie, Oxenfree." Uncle Cal didn't know about these rules, and I wasn't about to remind him. I wanted to find a new spot to hide. If I had to crouch down inside of a chicken coop one more time, I was going to scream. Cal hated to hide, so he volunteered to be it every time for this game. This was an added bonus. When I played my parents and their sisters, I had to be it all the time. I was slow and they were competitive, so they didn't hold back when they got the chance to tag me. "You have to count to 100," I informed my uncle as I led him to the shed that would be home base. "And you can't peek." He nodded along and turned to face the wall of the shed. I was running before he even started counting. I wasn't going to hide behind a gravestone or mausoleum. Even at a young age, I knew how disrespectful that would have been. But there was a patch of trees in the center of the yard that were calling to me. I discovered a few weeks ago that one of the trees, an aspen, had low-hanging branches that I could climb if I got a running start. Kids climbed one similar to it in the play area at school. I had joined in with them once, but my Aunt Gloria, who taught at the school with my mom Katie, was on playground duty that day, and she immediately made me get down. Without an adult to tell me no, and with at least another 60 seconds left, I sprinted through the cemetery towards my goal. The tree, that I have since named Eulalie, after the Edgar Allan Poe poem, welcomed me with yellowing leaves and white branches hanging down like arms outstretched for a hug. I didn't hesitate, in fact, I picked up speed and lunged as soon as I was within reach. With what I could only call pure luck, I was able to grab onto the lowest branch and pull myself up on the first try. I was only 5 or so feet off the ground, but I felt as though I had just climbed the Denali Peak. Knowing that I could still be seen in my bright blue jacket, I scrambled up a couple of more branches and positioned it so that I was behind a large cluster of leaves that had yet to fall. By the time I was fully situated, Cal was done counting and had been moving about the yard for a few minutes. He checked in the usual places that a 6-year-old may have hidden. Most of them were places that I frequented in hide-and-seeks of days past. A few places he looked in were ones that I had never thought of, but cataloged in my brain for the next time I played with my parents. I could see him quite easily from my little perch, and I was able to laugh at him without fear of being heard because he was nowhere near me. He was scratching his head and double-checking everywhere he previously looked before going into the house to search. At this point, I was getting sore, so I leaned back against the trunk of the tree and waited for him to come back out. The air was quiet, and I could hear the chirps of some birds nesting in the surrounding areas. If I hadn't been sitting on a narrow branch, sitting 20 feet above the ground, I would have allowed myself to drift off, but I stayed alert, hoping to see my uncle reappear soon. It was then that I felt a tingly feeling at the back of my neck. It wasn't unlike the sensation I got when my moms ran their fingers through my hair or rubbed my back. Feeling relaxed, I glanced about and just noticed how still it was in this little oasis centered in our cemetery. At this point, I was feeling rather euphoric. Suddenly, I really wanted to find my moms. I had this overwhelming need to tell them that I loved them and give them hugs. I felt guilty for going into the cemetery and breaking their rules. I quickly began to climb out of the tree, and in the process, I ended up missing a branch somehow and falling to the ground from about 8 feet up. Later on, I would learn that I broke my wrist and thumb when I landed, but somehow I didn't feel the pain. I just had to get to my parents. In my delusional state, I decided that the best route to take to get to town was through the woods behind the cemetery, probably because I was closer to the woods than I was to the road at that point. But the forest was thick and full of traps that had been set by hunters and forgotten about. It was another place I was told to avoid. Luckily, I didn't run into any traps that day. There was a pretty clear path that had been made by my mother Aga and her siblings back when they were young, so I stuck to that. That was when things got hazy. At some point, the euphoric sensation turned into one of dread. I began to feel as though someone or something was chasing me. I remember crying and calling out for Cal to come find me. Eventually, I blacked out. When I woke up, I was lying in a pile of leaves and staring up at the night sky. Pain was flaring up my right arm and my feet stung. Climbing to my feet, I looked around and realized I was still in the woods. It took me a moment to get my bearings, but soon I figured out where I was. I had only been a few yards from the path and headed in the direction of the cemetery. My jacket was gone, as were my shoes and socks. I don't know what the hell happened there. My tiny feet were freezing and stung against the rocky ground. When I emerged from the forest into the cemetery, I could see red lights flashing up by my house, and I immediately knew who they were for. For a moment, I contemplated turning back and living my life in the woods. But I soldiered on, and by the time I was halfway across the graveyard, I could hear someone shouting out my name. It was my mother, Katie. She was the strict one with an Irish temper and a hand made for spanking. When I saw her coming, running through the cemetery gate, though, I immediately felt a rush of relief. I couldn't run, I was too sore, and I could only hold up my left arm, but I called out to her as hot tears streamed down my cheeks. She picked me up and hugged me close. She didn't yell at me for wandering off, nor did she scold me for not wearing a coat or shoes. She just asked me if I was alright and told me that she loved me. Even then, when the adrenaline was coursing through my veins, I was relieved that she was taking pity on me. I was way too drained to get a spanking. Katie took me to the house where a hysterical Aga was waiting with her sisters and my Aunt Gloria. I didn't get to stay home though. Once they realized I'd been injured and out of the woods for nearly 12 hours, I was placed in the waiting ambulance and rushed to the town over for medical care. I was released the next day with a bright pink cast and an order to stay inside for at least 72 hours. The shaman visited us the next day. He was summoned by my grandfather after I told him about what led me into the woods. My parents stayed with me as I described the ordeal to the shaman. I told him about how happy I felt and how I had longed to be with my parents so much that I went into the woods that I feared more than any grave or mausoleum. After all was said and done, the shaman went out to the patch of trees I had been hiding in and began to bless them and burn sage and incense. He told my mothers that I could have been influenced by a spirit. He said that it was likely a young child who had passed and missed their parents. Katie, who wasn't as superstitious as her wife, was skeptical of this explanation. She believed in spirits and all, but she didn't think that they had the power to control living beings. But she didn't have a reasonable explanation as to why her 6-year-old wandered into the woods and blacked out. So they allowed the shaman to go through with his rituals and reinforced their rule that I wasn't to go into the cemetery alone. Uncle Cal, who had been royally terrified after the ordeal, was the only one to yell at me. I was surprised. He was always a pretty chill guy and he never really got on to me before that. But he had been terrified that he'd lost me forever. And when he found out that it was all because I had broken a rule that I was very familiar with, he blew his top. This is one of the many unexplained events that occurred in my childhood. I wish I knew more about what caused it, but even my tribe's leaders don't have an explanation. They just used it as an excuse to warn children not to wander about on hallowed land.
Part 6, A Shallow Burial.
This happened right after Aga and Katie moved into the main house. Papa and Ma wanted to retire early so that they could do some traveling before they got too old, so they gave the business over to my mom when I was about 4. I don't remember any of this, but my parents and aunts recalled most of the details. A little context on our house. The funeral parlor is attached to the main floor. There is an external entrance to it from the side of the house and an internal entrance in our kitchen. Because our town is so small, we only ever had a death happen every few months or so. Our cemetery is the only one in the country for our particular tribe. So if someone from the tribe passes away in another city, all of their embalming and burial preparations are done before they are sent to us. We have a small room for embalming in our parlor, an office, a showroom, and a storage space. Cremation was an option for those who were not natives, but those were done off-site. Katie was still wary of the new home by this point, but she agreed to do all the clerical work in the office while Agatha and Charlie, her assistant at the time, did more of the hands-on stuff. I was only going to school on half days, so on the afternoons where my aunts and uncles couldn't look after me, I was sequestered to the office with Katie. I didn't mind this. I just colored and watched movies on the tiny television that she kept in the corner. On this day, the two of us were waiting for my Aunt Gloria to pick us up for lunch when a group of people came into the parlor. It was an older woman with long gray curls flanked by two men, one about the same age as the lady and the other in his teens. They weren't Inuit by the looks of it. They weren't from our town. So Katie was a bit startled by their arrival. She asked them, "How may I help you?" as she came out of the office. She was hungry and had a cranky kid begging to get out of the stuffy house, so she had to force herself to be friendly. The woman said, "We have someone we'd like to bury." She said it so casually that Katie had to ask her to repeat herself. "My boy," the man spoke this time, "he needs to be buried." Katie grabbed the clipboard with the schedule on it and began to look at it. "I'm terribly sorry for your loss. Do you have a plot reserved?" She knew they didn't, but she was mostly curious about what they would say. Our cemetery isn't necessarily exclusive, but it was kind of an unspoken rule that we didn't just bury anyone there. It was a place for people of our tribe mostly, but a lot of Russian Orthodox families had sections within the gates as well. Other than that, there were maybe 20 or so other citizens laid to rest, but those were people who had lived in our town. By this point, Katie had lived in the town for nearly a decade, so she knew everyone who lived there. She'd even memorized the regulars who passed through during hunting season. These people didn't look at all familiar. No reservations, the man shook his head. "He died just last night. We haven't made any arrangements." He seemed agitated, and that was something Katie was definitely not accustomed to. The normal patrons to the parlor were usually grieving and very quiet. She said calmly, "Well, if we don't have something reserved, we wouldn't be able to bury him right away. There are some forms that need to be filled out, and you have to meet with the town council and shaman." The lady scoffed, "Oh, none of that business. Just bury the kid." Katie insisted, "That's not how it works." Her patience was wearing thin, and she knew that if they pushed her too much, then her Irish rage would come out, and no one wanted that. Luckily, at that moment, Aga came out of the back room. She must have heard the commotion because she immediately approached the trio and confronted them in a calm but authoritative manner that only she could accomplish. When they repeated their request, she shook her head. "I'm so sorry for your loss. How old was he?" She placed a comforting hand on the woman's shoulder, but was immediately shrugged off. "He just turned 12. Are you going to bury him or not?" Aga observed. "That's awfully young. I'm sorry to ask, but how did he pass?" The older man waved her off. "That's not your concern." Aga remained calm. If he's to be buried on my land." She even offered him a charming smile. "And if he hasn't been examined by a shaman or a medical doctor, at the very least, I can't begin with the embalming process." We don't want any of that. Just throw his body into the ground." The man's words had Katie picking me up and locking me in the office. I was young and oblivious, so I had no idea what was being said or what it meant. But she didn't want me being around people who held such disregard for their deceased child. Aga was a little flustered by this point. She pushed her own superstitions aside and did her best to swallow her anger. "We don't just throw bodies in the ground, sir. There are protocols that need to be followed." She went over to the phone on the far wall of the parlor. "If you're in a hurry, we can have the shaman here in the next hour. If everything goes according to plan, we can have your son interred by the weekend." She was being generous. Normally, we just don't give plots out willy-nilly, but she didn't want to have any more trouble with these people. But it still wasn't good enough for them. The woman shouted, "No one will touch my boy," shoving Aga away. By this point, Charlie, my parents' assistant, had also emerged from the back. He grabbed the woman and pushed her away from my mother's. Still chalking the whole thing up to them being grieving parents, Aga assured Charlie that she was okay and continued to reason with the family. "I know that this is a very difficult time for you, but I'm afraid there isn't any other option," she informed them. "I simply cannot bury someone without following the protocol. I'm sorry." "Never mind." The man grabbed his wife and the teenager and shoved them back towards the exit. "We'll just take care of it ourselves." And then they left. My parents wanted to feel guilty about not going after them, but they had been so spooky. Katie maintained that she was relieved that they didn't have to do business with them, even if they were going through a hard time. About a half hour later, my Aunt Gloria arrived to take us lunch. While she waited for Katie to get me ready to go out, she made a passing comment about the people she passed on the drive up to the house. "It looks like they were burying a dog or something near the cemetery. Is that allowed?" Immediately, Katie stopped what she was doing and stormed out of the office to get Aga. They called my Uncle Cal, who got there just in time to stop the family before they drove off. They had buried their kid in the shallow grave less than 20 feet from the front entrance of the cemetery. His body had been wrapped up in an old quilt, and he only had a pair of underwear on. Furious, Cal tied the couple up and made them sit in the back of his truck until the authorities arrived to take them into proper custody. After taking the body into the city for an exam, and after interrogating the family, my parents got an update on what happened. The family was from a rural area of the tundra, where they lived mostly off of the land, and they rarely relied on electricity. On the evening before their visit to our parlor, the teenager had lost his temper on his younger brother and strangled him with some fishing line. It was never made clear to us why the family came to our town to request a burial. No one in the area knew them, and our cemetery wasn't advertised on billboards or anything. Their shack was only about 5 miles or so from our property, so Aga claimed that it was probably a matter of convenience. If they buried him on the actual tundra, they would have run the risk of his body being dug up by animals. We soon found out that his family never paid for a proper burial for the kid, so he'd been cremated and likely forgotten about. Aga had a small headstone made and placed in the spot where they had tried to bury him on our property.
Part 7, When Grief Leads.
Around the time of my 9th birthday, I was stuck working with my mothers, Katie and Aga, in the parlor. I didn't have to actually work with the deceased, but my parents realized that I was unlike a comfort pet when it came to the town locals. They all loved the little mixed girl who lived with the lesbians on the hill. So when a grieving family came in, Aga would pull me out of the office and sit me down next to the woman while she went over details with the men. I didn't really mind it. I usually came out the other end with a payment candy and new toys. Plus, I was a pretty nice kid. I didn't resent comforting mourning widows and children. On a crisp morning in April, we were scheduled to see a family who had just lost their twin sons in a car accident. The boys were a grade older than me in school, so Aga asked that I come out and give their mother, Kyla, my condolences. Kyla was an older mother, and her husband, Hot, was a good decade younger than her, but they were a lovely couple whom everyone respected. The boys were their only children, so it was no surprise that they were shaken to the core over this loss. I, too, had been pretty devastated by my classmates' deaths. We didn't see a lot of young kids die in our parts, so I was pretty sincere when I came into the waiting area. Kyla wrapped me up in a big hug and sat on the couch with me in her lap, while Aga showed Hot into the back where my Uncle Cal was building the boys' coffins. I didn't really understand why I had to sit in the woman's lap. I sat in my mom's lap from time to time, but I was at an age where I really preferred to find my own seat. But the lady was grieving, so I allowed her to rock me back and forth and cry softly into my shoulder. After a few minutes of this, she lifted her head and craned her neck to look out the window behind us. "Will they be buried next to each other?" I responded confidently. "Yes, they have the space all picked out." I had helped my uncle clear the space of weeds and brush the day before. Kyla asked, her voice still thick with emotion, "Can I see it?" I shook my head and pointed in the direction of the back room where Aga was. I told her, "When they're done, my mom will take you." But she was standing me up before climbing to her feet before I could even finish my sentence. "Please, take me, Rosemary." It came out as a command, but she was still shaking from despair, so I had to relent. I wasn't a complete idiot, though. I went into the office where Katie was working and asked her if it would be okay. She, of course, hesitated, but she too wanted to do what she could to make Kyla feel better. "Well, why don't you two head outside, and I'll meet you out there in just a moment," she suggested, smiling over my shoulder at Kyla. I nodded and took the older woman's hand before leading her towards the back door. When we stepped out, I immediately wished that I had grabbed my coat from the office. The air was way colder than the sunshine suggested it would be. I released Kyla's hand to rub my hands over my arms, and she knelt down to wrap me up in an embrace. She asked me, "Dear, do you need a jacket?" I assured her, "My mom will probably bring it out in a minute." I have a blanket in the truck. Do you want that?" I answered, no, thank you. I'll be okay." I shook my head with a small smile. My parents had trained me to always have a somber and subdued expression when speaking to the mourning. Kyla picked me up and hugged me close. She insisted, "Let's get that blanket," walking us toward the old pickup truck parked just a few feet away. Again, I found myself a little annoyed. First of all, I had two working legs. I did not need to be carried. Secondly, I didn't want a blanket. If I was that desperate for warmth, I would have gone back in and gotten my coat. Kyla opened up the bed of the truck and sat me on the tailgate before climbing up herself. She went over to the cage Hot used for his dogs and opened it up to reveal a small stack of gray fleece blankets. Realizing that she was about to wrap me in a blanket soaked in dog pee and slobber, I shook my head again. "Oh, I'm okay, really." I moved to jump down from the tailgate, but she got me and picked me up again. "Don't argue with me, sweetheart. It's for your own good." She practically swaddled me in the stinky material and held me close. "Now, are you ready for bed?" Before I could ask her what she meant, she tossed me forcefully into the cage and closed the door. I hit my head on one of the thick metal bars and was possibly knocked out for a moment. The next thing I knew, the truck was rocking back and forth and was being driven down our dirt road. I don't really remember screaming or anything. I think I was mostly dazed, but I was also wondering if I should have been humoring the woman still. Kyla didn't take me to their house. Instead, she went to a small motel just outside of town. She didn't get a room, she just parked and climbed into the bed of the truck to release me from the pen. She cradled me in her lap and ran her fingertips over my bloody forehead. She apologized for hurting me and kissed my cheeks. I was still at a loss. Was this still a grieving mother who just needed a kid to hug? At what point was I supposed to call it batshit crazy and cry out for my parents? Nonetheless, I really felt as if I was going to vomit, so I just allowed her to hold me and soothe me. We sat that way for what felt like hours. The owner of the motel came out at one point, probably to see who belonged to the sole vehicle sitting in his parking lot. When he saw me, his eyes widened and he asked Kyla if he needed to call an ambulance. She insisted that we were fine and calmly told him to go on his way. He must have gone in and called the police because the next thing I knew, sirens were wailing into the parking lot. Kyla didn't even flinch. She just made a little shushing noise and pulled me closer. She instructed, "Go to sleep, honey." The police began yelling for her to put her hands up, but she didn't listen. Then, like music in the air, Aga's voice overpowered theirs. She was calling out to me and asking not only if I was okay, but if Kyla was all right as well. I sat up and begged for my mother to come and get me. I couldn't be polite anymore. There weren't enough toys in the world to make this whole experience worth it. Aga threw open the bed of the truck and pulled me out of Kyla's arms before the police could even finish telling her to step away from the vehicle. She continued to ignore them as she scolded Kyla for taking me and injuring me in the process. But then she went on to comfort her and tell her that her boys were ready for their ceremonies and that she could view them at any time. She didn't yell, she didn't press charges, she didn't hate the woman for what she did. She still maintains that Kyla was acting out of grief and that she couldn't be blamed for being human. I don't necessarily disagree, but I was still mad that she wrapped me in the dog blanket. Kitty, on the other hand, was ready to track the woman down and tear her apart limb from limb, hashtag Irish. That's why she stayed at the house while Aga went to the police to report the abduction. Kyla never attempted anything like that again, but she still never fully recovered from the loss of her sons. Hot ended up checking her into a nursing home in Fairbanks because she had become too far gone. This was the moment in my life that I learned that grief can become too powerful of an emotion for some people to handle.
Part 8, Their Cursed Agenda.
I've been getting a lot of stories from my moms and other family members. Aga, the more cavalier of my two mothers, just told me one that really freaked her out, and I had to tell it before I forgot it. This happened when Katie was pregnant with me. My parents, along with Katie's twin sister Gloria, were still living in the guest house towards the back of our property. When she was about 7 months into her pregnancy, Katie was put on bed rest because she had been showing early signs of preeclampsia, and even the shaman was suggesting that they might have needed to send her to a hospital if they weren't careful. But my lesbian parents were already facing a lot of ridicule from Aga's side of the family for breaking tradition, and Katie would have hated to make it worse. Aunt Gloria was living with them to help care for her sister, and Aga was home most of the time, so there wasn't really any risk of Katie doing anything on her own. It bothered her to no end, but she wanted a healthy baby and somewhat easy birth, so she did as she was told. It was late July, a time of the year where there was sunlight all day and night, and it made things quite difficult for my very pregnant mother. They had thick curtains, but they did nothing to fully block the sun out, so Aga decided to go into the city and buy blackout curtains. It was a 2-hour drive there and back, but there was nowhere in the village where she could buy them, and my Uncle Cal's offer to make curtains out of bear pelts was quickly rejected. Gloria was very protective of her twin, so she was on high alert 99% of the time, but on this day, she had a terrible head cold. Katie made her stay far away and insisted on taking care of herself that day. The shaman had said that she should only get up when necessary, but Katie figured that walking around some was better than catching a cold. Later that afternoon, Katie began hearing people speaking just outside. She rolled herself out of bed and peered out of the window that looked over the front yard. There wasn't anyone there. Frustrated, she put on her robe and crept into the living room. Gloria had fallen asleep on the couch just outside of their bedroom, so my mom had to tiptoe past her to get to the front door. She had been abducted from their house before, so she was very cautious as she opened the door and looked around. The voices were louder, and now she could hear some sort of soft music playing. After examining her surroundings, she determined that no one was close enough to the house or their section of the cemetery to pose any concern. Shutting the door, she went into the kitchen to call my Uncle Cal and informed him of what she heard. After getting the assurance that he would look into it, she hung up and went back to bed. An hour had passed and Katie could still hear the people. Their music had turned out to be metal instruments banging together like trash can lids. It sounded like they were just outside of the house, but every time she looked outside, no one was there. Finally, Gloria came in and asked what was going on. She was drugged up and only one of her ears worked, but even she could hear the racket. Fed up, Katie called Cal again and asked him if he could take care of the people. She even gave him permission to bring Myrna, his pet wolf, to slaughter the strangers if necessary. Obviously, she didn't want people to actually be killed, but she was exhausted and hormonal, so she felt that she was well within her right to put a hit out. To her surprise, Cal informed her that he had driven out there right after her first call and hadn't seen anyone. Katie opened the window and held the phone up so that he could hear the music and chanting, just to prove that she wasn't losing her mind. When she put the phone back to her ear, Cal was yelling something about staying in the house and locking all the doors and windows. He hung up before she could ask him why. Gloria made sure Katie was situated in bed before she did everything that Cal ordered. She even went into the attic to close the shutters to the window. She even went into the attic to close the shutters to the windows up there and then down into the basement to seal the external cellar doors from inside. It was when she was coming back through the living room that she saw the people responsible for all the noise. They were dressed in anoraks, long parkas, with furred collars. Those along with their long pants seemed to be made out of some sort of animal skin. It wasn't typical for the people within our village to wear such garb unless there was some sort of festival or ceremony taking place. What really startled Gloria, though, were the masks. They all had round masks with slanted eye holes and feathers along the top. They were all dancing and banging on their respective instruments, but my aunt didn't get a very good look before darting into the bedroom and shutting and locking the door behind her. She pulled Katie back over to the window. My mother recalls that she thought she was going to drop me then and there. The men, she was pretty sure they were all men, weren't hiding now. They were proudly dancing and chanting as though they knew they had an audience. Katie was just about to call an ambulance when she heard someone shouting from the other side of the yard. She was filled with relief when she saw not only my Uncle Cal, but also Rock. They were the biggest men in town, and when the strangers saw them, they didn't even flinch. Marina was attached to the leash clenched in Cal's hand, and she was snarling at the men as though she were ready to pounce. The leader of the group approached my uncle and Rock and spoke to them for a few minutes. Katie and Gloria couldn't hear them, but Cal later informed them of what was said. The leader gestured towards the house. "That baby cannot be born. It will only bring evil." This is a rough translation, but essentially these guys thought that I was an abomination, not only because my moms were lesbians, but also because I was half white. Rock, the coolest guy I know, throat punched the guy as Cal let go of Myrna, who chased the rest of the men. Their chants turned into high-pitched screams of terror as they fled into the direction of the woods. They tied up the leader and chained him to the bumper of Cal's truck before calling Myrna back over and heading inside. As soon as they walked in the door, they ordered Katie to lay down while Cal called the shaman, who was there within a half hour. He asked Katie how long she'd listened to the chanting before calling the men. He felt her stomach and said some prayers over her. When the police later arrived to retrieve the leader, they found that he had escaped his bonds and disappeared without a trace. They came in and questioned my aunt and uncles while Katie was undergoing a cleansing ritual with the shaman. Aga got home around that point, and when she was apprised of the situation, she was convinced that I was dead and that her wife was going to die as well. She became inconsolable, and when Katie went into premature labor the next night, she insisted on taking her to the hospital because the shaman had already done his part and it hadn't worked. I was born 2 months early, but my health hadn't been too poor. The doctor said that it could have been the stress of the situation that triggered the early labor, but of course Aga and her family thought differently. Katie wasn't told until months later what the men had said to Cal and Rock and what their chant was about. They had been asking their ancestors to strangle me within my mother's womb and to destroy her from the inside out. Luckily, it didn't work, or my uncles got there in time to stop it. The weird thing is, my Aunt Gloria was never able to get pregnant. In fact, she developed an infection less than a year later that required the removal of one of her ovaries. She has been to a few specialists, but none of them are able to tell her exactly what caused her infertility. Nobody had ever been able to find the men who started all of this. But this wasn't the first or last time there had been reports of tribesmen performing unorthodox rituals to suit their own needs or beliefs. Thank you for listening to Just the Terror with Nick Guerra. Make sure to check out True Scary Stories with Edie on Tuesdays. Give it 5 stars. And stay scared, uglies.